Time for the Tom Sumner Program. The Tom Sumner Program is a live variety show with music, comedy and special guest interviews every Monday through Friday.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom. You know that.
Yay, Tom! I love it in Flint!
You're very astute, Tom.
Tom, easy question.
I'll debate Andy Dillon on your show.
Well, that's a very good question.
Hello, darling. This is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, with Tom Sumner.
I'm all right, Tom. How are you?
Hey, lucky day, Mr. Sumner.
Ciao, Tom. How are you today?
That's a good question.
Hi, this is actor-comedian Jonah Pody, and you're listening to the Tom Snyder, Tom Smothers. I'm sorry, what's his name? Oh, Sumner. The Tom Sumner Program.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
Hey, at least I got the Tom part right.
Stay tuned, because it's on now. The Tom Sumner Program.
COVID-19 is the biggest health crisis in our lifetime. We're working around the clock with doctors and hospitals to stop it, but we need your help. Even if you don't feel sick, you could be carrying it. And just one person with the virus can infect another 40, who then infect thousands more. So I've issued an executive order requiring everyone to stay home to help limit the spread of the virus. Let's protect the people we love. Stay home and stay safe.
Hi, this is Gretchen Whitmer, and you're listening to the Tom Sumner Program.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. As we roll into the second hour of our three-hour tour, we're going to be talking with this hour. My guest is, a labor organizer, teacher, and author of a new book called Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. I'm sure we'll end up talking a little bit about workers in a post-pandemic America with Sean Richmond, who joins me now by phone. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Sean, let's talk about this because there has been a pendulum swinging with regard to organized labor, and nobody knows that better than people here in the state of Michigan, and in particular in Flint, where my show is based. And often considered as the birthplace of the UAW, that's been swinging back away from organized labor. In fact, in recent years, there are more public employees that are members of unions than private employees that are members of unions. Do you see that changing, and how does that change come about? Are we back to sit down strikes and work stoppages to be able to collectively bargain and organize?
I mean, strikes are going to be essential to restoring our rights. The reason that you've got such low union density and such declining union membership figures is that the legal system is just completely broken. It's become a trap for unions. And, you know, it's broken because employers have spent the last 50 years seceding from the system. It's broken because the National Labor Relations Board, when you have a Republican administration, becomes a union-busting firm. And then when you've got Democrats, it's underfunded and can't investigate. It's tied up in knots over a bunch of court decisions. And employers have, you know, employers will do anything they can to remove workers from the protections of the Act. They'll making you be a freelance or employing you by a subcontractor, and of course by offshoring as many jobs as possible. If we had a democracy, then 60% of the workers in this country who want to have a union would have a union. Instead, they're restricted by a broken system.
Now, I understand the right to work law's impact on, let's call it what it is, union busting. But how did the Taft-Hartley Act impact organized labor?
So the Taft-Hartley Act is where the carve out of federal law, which allowed states to pass these so-called right to work laws, That's where it's found, and that's what we tend to mostly think of Taft-Hartley. But in reality, the real damage that Taft-Hartley did is that it outlawed solidarity. It made it illegal for a group of workers to take a dispute to a secondary employer, a company that does business with your own direct employer in any fashion. So as an example, you know, there was a Oreo cookie factory in Chicago that Nabisco closed down and decided to start, you know, cooking those cookies in Mexico instead. And so a bunch of, you know, about 1,000 unionized jobs were lost. Now, the appropriate response would be for supermarket workers around the country to say, look, we're not going to stock Oreo cookies. We're not going to put them on the shelves. We're not going to get them off the trucks until those workers in Chicago get their job back. That's where the power would be, right? But to do so would be completely illegal. And this isn't like slap on the wrist illegal. The employer would be able to go directly to the courts and sue the unions for triple damages. And of course, they would claim that it's costing them $1 billion. And then the union would be out of business. It'd be bankrupt. There's no equivalent for employer behavior. Employers can break the law left and right. They do all the time. And there's no financial damages. It's got to go through this long, torturous process. And so that's really where the damage is. And aside from the Taft-Hartley Act, actually, the reality is before the Taft-Hartley Act was even passed, the Supreme Court did massive damage to what was intended to be a pro-union law, a law that was intended to encourage collective bargaining as federal policy. You know, one of the things that the Supreme Court did, this is sort of, you know, this was sort of a ticking time bomb that nobody recognized at the time, but in 1938, there was a Supreme Court decision called McKay Radio, where, you know, even though the law says that striking is legally protected activity, and it would be completely illegal to discriminate against anybody who engages in strikes or legally protected activity, in this throwaway line, the Supreme Court said, well, but of course, if it was necessary to protect and continue his business, an employer should be allowed to replace those striking workers as long as it's done on a non-discriminatory basis, which means, you know, sort of do it by seniority, I guess. And, you know, it sat there in the law for decades until a copper mining company called Phelps Dodge in 1982 dusted it off, bargained their union to impasse over draconian cuts in wages and benefits, bust in thousands of scabs, and waited the union out for a year so that the scabs could decertify the union. And that became the playbook, the standard playbook of how much of industry in this country became de-unionized. So that's not the Taft-Hartley Act. That's the courts. The courts have done real damage because judges are not workers. They don't think like workers.
Has technology had an impact on whether or not there are even going to be workers to organize? We're seeing more and more, especially in manufacturing, that artificial intelligence and robots and mechanized systems are replacing workers in huge numbers. And some people, like Andrew Yang, for example, what was the name of his book? The War on Work, was it? But he's the one who ran for president and advocated a universal basic income because, as he argues, a lot of jobs won't exist 10 years from now, 20 years from now. How do you get people into jobs to then organize?
Well, I think the problem of AI and automation is overstated. There's always been automation. Automation has existed since workers first started organizing. As soon as workers get organized and get the leverage to demand more, employers will try to figure out how to automate as much of the work as possible so that there's fewer of them and they have less leverage. That's been going on for 150 years. There's nothing new about it. There are still, however, plenty of jobs. One of the things that drives me nuts about that, about Yang's argument, is think about elder care. Think about child care, but particularly think about elder care. All these baby boomers who are don't want to be in nursing homes necessarily, want to try to live at home for as much as possible. care is work. There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to get done. And, you know, these are essential workers who are mainly, you know, getting very sick during this pandemic. Those could be good jobs. Those should be good jobs. What keeps them from being good jobs is the law and the lack of workplace protections and good, strong union laws for people who are frequently treated like independent contractors. If you think about the work of elder care, it's a lot of heavy lifting. It's a lot, you know, there's a real requirement to, you know, have some medical training. That sounds to me like it should be a $50 an hour job, like auto work is. But you need to have a union, and you need to have the ability to form a union and have the government enforce that right to have a union.
And what about the efforts to unionize fast food workers? That was something we always considered was kind of entry level, first job, you know, maybe even a high school job, you know, a first experience. But more and more, we're finding people are turning to those jobs to make a living. Is that where the labor movement needs to go? Is where the workers are?
I mean, that's a basic principle of labor, is go where the workers are. And because our system of labor relations is so broken, you know, you look at what the heavily unionized industries are in this country. It's teachers, it's hotels, it's healthcare. But if you're looking at the economy in terms of where, you know, what are the most important industries? What are the most politically influential industries? What is the auto work of today? You know, I mean, cars made this country in a lot of ways. What's the equivalent of that today? Well, I think it's the tech center. I think it is fast food and food production in general. I think it's financial services. And you don't have a lot of unions there because, again, the law gets in the way. Now, you know, you take a McDonald's. Where I think the vast majority of McDonald's workers want to have a union. The way that the system is broken is the union would be forced to get certified on a store by store basis for the most part, even though it's all one giant company. But because of the franchise model of the stores, McDonald's gets to say we're not the employer of record. And so, you know, the reason that SEIU is running the Fight for 15 campaign the way it is they knew that if they went for certification elections, well, stores would close immediately, then pop up again with a, you know, slightly different articles of incorporation, you know, around the corner from the old location, completely legal, and they just be, you know, they just be treading sand. So that instead, what they want to do is to take the fight to the corporate level, take the fight to the legislatures to get you know, these minimum wage increases, and put pressure on McDonald's around the system to eventually get some sort of framework. But it shouldn't have to be that hard. And what I'm arguing for in my book is we should have all-in systems of labor relations. There should be, an industrial, at the sectoral level, there should be an industrial labor board that could set the terms for all fast food stores across the country. And whatever that term is, you know, it could be the $15 minimum wage. Frankly, I think we need to be at the $20 minimum wage at this point. It could be banning the practice of clopins, which is, this is where a store makes an employee close up at the end of the day and then report to work for the first shift in the morning, so that you're only home for, like, you know, 6 hours. You don't really get any sleep. You didn't really get any time off. Make that a rule so that no store across the country can do it. Give the union the ability to bargain, you know, with this industrial labor board, and then apply it across across the country, rather than, you know, trying to get back to unions having a, you know, being certified on a workplace by workplace basis, somehow bootstrapping our way up to 33% density, and thinking that we can get back to the way things used to work, which is, you know, the union standards, you know, in one large firm or in one significant industry would have a ripple effect across other companies within that industry, or even other unrelated industries. Right? Once upon a time, the UAW GM contract had a real impact on cost of living adjustments for everybody. Had a real impact on what inflation was. had a real impact on what kind of health benefits you would get, you know, at a bank. That just doesn't work anymore, and it can't work because the employers are have too many tools at their disposal to deceive from that system.
Sean, I want to talk about this some more, but I have a break coming up here in about 30 seconds. Can you stick around and we'll dig down some more on this?
Sure.
All right. My guest is Sean Richman, a labor organizer, teacher, and author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. And we'll talk some more with Sean after we let our broadcast partner squeeze a few words in or do whatever they do when we go to break. They are WFOV 92.1 FM in Flint. If you're streaming us at TomSumnerProgram.com, we have some messages as well. So don't touch that dial. Don't click that mouse. We'll be right back.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Hi, this is Mark Farner, and you're listening to the Tom Sumner Program.
I'm Julie Lopez with Crime Stoppers. Have you ever wondered what to do if you have information about a crime or the whereabouts of a felony fugitive and you want the police to know but you need to remain anonymous? Well, here's what you can do. You can go to p3tips.com or download the mobile app. You can go to Crime Stoppers of Flint and Genesee County's Facebook page and click on the Leave an Anonymous Tip tab, or you can call 1-800-422-JAIL. All methods are anonymous, and if your help leads to a felony arrest, you may be eligible for a cash reward. Remember, your voice matters.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jonae Caldoun. We know that COVID-19 is spreading rapidly across Michigan right now. The most important thing people can do to protect themselves is social distancing. That means unless you are a critical infrastructure worker or going out to get food or medicine for your home, you should be staying at home. Stay home, stay safe, save lives.
The Spangled Dwarf in his bow tie. The infantry that don't ask why.
Hi, I'm Bob Dylan. Remember those fabulous 60s? The marches, the bands, the draft card burnings, and best of all, the music. Well, now Apple House has collected the finest of those songs on one album called Golden Protest, performed by the original artists who made them famous. You'll thrill to Society's Child by Janis Ian, Pleasant Valley Sunday by the Monkees, What Have They Done to the Rain by the Searchers, In the Ghetto by Elvis Presley, Silent Night 7 O'Clock News by Simon and Garfunkel, and who can ever forget this all-time classic? Yes, it's Barry McGuire's immortal Eve of Destruction. And, of course, my own Masters of War, all for the incredibly low price of $3.95. And if you order now, you'll also receive a treasury of acid rock featuring Vanilla Fudge, Blue Chair, Frigid Pink, Moby Grape, The Electric Prunes, Jeff Snareplane, Lotharian Hand People, to name but a few. Plus, as part of this special limited offer, you also get the best of the supergroups with Traffic, Cream, Blind Faith, Ginger Baker's Air Force, and many, many others. Yes, this is a collector's dream. Golden Protest, plus two fabulous 60s albums, all for only $3.95. If you were to purchase these selections separately, they'd cost you hundreds of dollars, and many cannot be found anywhere at any price. Well, it's time for my boot heels to be wandering. But here's something that'll tell you how you can get this amazing record package.
Here's how to order this amazing record package. Just send $3.95 and check your money order plus your name and address to Apple House Box 70K, South Bend, Indiana. Once again, that's $3.95 and check your money to Apple House Box 70K. Do it today.
Imagine a journey down a picturesque riverway. Imagine your Flint River, 142 miles of recreation, natural beauty, and precious resources. The Flint River is a vital resource that is available for all to use and enjoy. The river and its ecosystem provide unlimited recreational opportunities and natural beauty while supporting wildlife in a vibrant landscape. We all have a responsibility to protect and preserve this precious resource. Learn more at FlintRiver.org or call the Flint River Watershed Coalition at 810-767-6490.
Tom Sumner. Technical assistance for the Tom Sumner Program is provided by Swiftlet Technology, engineering and IT services at swiftlet.technology.
This is Jill Stein, and you're listening to the Tom Sumner Program.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We continue my conversation with labor organizer, teacher, and author Sean Richmond. Sean, welcome back.
Thanks.
Thanks for sticking around. You were talking just before we went to break about setting some national guidelines, whether it's raising the minimum wage or setting some workplace standards that would be sort of universal across the board. Isn't there a National Labor Relations Board, and what is their role in all this?
So the National Labor Relations Board is it's our nation's main labor law. It applies to most private sector workers, or it was intended to apply to most private sector workers. And, you know, it will certify that a majority of workers at an individual workplace want to have a union. It will direct the employer to bargain in good faith. And if the employer breaks the law, it is empowered to investigate and to prosecute if somebody is terminated for their union activity, if they're discriminated against, if the employer does not in fact bargain in good faith. That's at least the intention of the law. And again, it's broken in a lot of ways, hampered by a lot of bad court decisions, used as a union busting tool in Republican administrations and defunded during Democratic administrations. But the bigger sort of structural problem with it, and the thing I'm trying to put my finger on in this book, excuse me, is this. Think of a union as a workplace government. Because, you know, the right wing likes to analogize NLRB elections as you know, like a congressional election. So when we were trying to get the law amended to have the elections be by card check certification, just count the cards, and if a majority of people sign the cards, there's a union. And they said, oh, the sanctity of the secret ballot. But when you do a congressional election, you're not voting on whether there's going to be a government. You're merely voting for who is going to represent me for the next term. Here, it's a high-stakes election for whether there's going to be any form of democracy at all. Now, every workplace essentially has a government. We don't think of it that way, but they do. If there's no union, it's a dictatorship. Yeah. But a union at least turns it into, you know, a sort of a constitutional monarchy. The boss still has most of the power to make the decisions in the workplace, but you get to bargain over them. So we need a framework that's going to put a government in every workplace in America on day one. So an industrial labor board model is one, and there I'm harking back to the National Industrial Recovery Act, sort of the first labor law that the Roosevelt administration passed in 1933. It was overturned by the Supreme Court and then sort of, you know, forgotten. But something really happened there, I think, that we don't appreciate. And the National Labor Relations Act was actually being drafted at the time to be the enforcement mechanism for the National Industrial Recovery Act. So it was meant to sort of be side by side. You'd have this industrial board that could apply standards to every company and an entire industry, and you'd also have the NLRB that could force individual employers to negotiate with the union. So an industrial labor relations board, an industrial labor board is one sort of all-in model. Another all-in model that I play with some ideas in the book is looking to Germany and their works council model. And in Germany, it's exactly that. There is a workplace government. The employer has to pay for it. It is where a lot of what in this country we would view as being in a union contract is adjudicated there, and a lot of disciplinary matters are adjudicated there. And so, you know, there are these periodic elections where, you know, a number, you know, you have a bunch of unions, you know, running their leaders for spots in, you know, of responsibility within that works council. And you have some unions that are closer to the company, you know, we would call them company unions around here. You have some unions that are you know, aligned, you know, more communist, more anarchist, you know, they have much more political ideology. And it sort of frees the union up to be more political because there's a government in place no matter what. I think that's a model that we should look at. Another model that I point to is sort of a real sort of just a baseline right that we should have in this country that you know we're alone in the Western industrialized world for not having, is a just cause right to your job. Put it in the law. What we have instead, you know, if you're non-union, you basically you have a thing called at will, which is an invention of 19th century judges. Yeah, basically says, you know, you can't be forced to work under terms that you don't like. You're allowed to quit.
How frustrating is it that the phrase right to work has been co-opted?
I mean, I think right to your job is a good sort of, you know, good sort of contrast with right to work. And I think we should be talking about a right to your job more, because yeah, it's a total con, the use of the word right to work, the phrase right to work. Bosses have been using the concept of right to work for, you know, they were using it for decades before the Taft-Hartley Act. I mean, it's just really Orwellian. It's like, you know, the right to work is, we don't want you to have a union. The power that employers have over their non-union workers, the ability to fire you for a bad reason, for no reason at all, I mean, workers know this, and it absolutely hampers new organizing, and it absolutely hampers workers fighting back, pushing back on the job, you know. And that ability to fire is you know, I think there's a real Me Too connection to that, right? Like Matt Lauer, you know. Pressuring employees to come up to his hotel room when they're out, you know, doing field segments. Where did he get that power from? Oh, the fact that he could let you go, and it's not for that reason. He doesn't have to say what the reason was, and you know that they could just let you go. You know, we need a right to our job so that workers have more power to say no against unrelated job, you know, demands on the job.
How do you square a right to your job against? Something I've heard people say for years and years, most of my life, that the world doesn't owe you a living.
Well, I wonder how big I can go with that concept. I think the world does actually owe you a living. We live in a society together. Wealth is socially produced. It should be shared in a more democratic fashion. But again, I mean, on the right to your job in particular, it's a standard across the world. And part of the issue here is our Bill of Rights. You know, when the founding fathers were drafting the Bill of Rights, they had no concept of a private sector. They were drafting those Bill of Rights to be rights that you have in society. So the right of due process was meant to be just. You know, you can't have stuff taken away from you without a fair hearing. It's the judges in the decades that followed the American Revolution who started narrowly defining these concepts and created the at-will standard. So again, that's where it comes from, and that's why other countries have it, because the other countries have a broader concept of due process.
Yeah, I would also sort of. stick in there that not only did the framers not have any concept of a private sector, I don't think they were trying to curb the development of a public sector.
I don't know about that. I mean, I just, you know, honestly, just things just got stolen, you know, like people. People got their stuff together. They're like, this is mine, right? That's all it is, you know. Like the state of New Jersey incorporated Princeton University as the College of New Jersey. Someone somewhere along the line decided this is mine. You know, I mean that's so wealth is socially produced, and you know it's about individuals sort of taking without without sharing.
One thing that I want to make sure that we touch on, because you know we're still in a place where businesses have been ordered to close down because of COVID-19, because of the pandemic, and just beginning to open back up, and with all kinds of new restrictions as to how much capacity they can allow, you know, like restaurants at half capacity and that sort of thing. And for that reason, a lot of people are pretty insecure about whether or not their jobs are going to be there, or, and if jobs are going to be there going forward at the levels they were pre-pandemic. What about timing? You know, when you talk about getting a movement going to support everyone's right to a job and to move unions back to the prominence they once had, how does that factor in an economy that's crawling to get back to its feet?
Yeah, I mean, I'm worried that we're heading towards a new Great Depression, for sure. But I would say, I mean, the pandemic has really laid bare just how unequal our society is, and how few rights we had, and how, you know, the old normal was unacceptable, and left us particularly vulnerable for exactly what's happening. So there is no going back to the old normal, and there shouldn't be. That shouldn't be our goal as a society. Our goal should be to build something better. The timing, also interesting. I mean, you know, I obviously wrote this book before COVID.
Yeah.
And you know, I write about strikes a lot in there, and how hard it is to revive the strike weapon, because strikes are contagious. And so workers need to see other workers go on strike and win in order to start thinking about what that would look like in their own workplace. And, you know, 2019 was a real high watermark for strike activity in the United States in the 21st century. But I was also trying to throw some cold water on that, because it was not a strike wave. All we really did is we got back to 1986 levels of striking. And 1986 was a lousy year for strikes. That was a year where, you know, the Phelps-Dodge playbook was getting run, and unions were losing strikes. So the contagion went the wrong way. And workers feared strikes as a strategy, because they saw it as a way to lose throughout the 80s and 90s. I think that what was encouraging about the 2019 strikes is and 2018, the Red for Edge strikes, you know, in southern states even, that people were seeing that as workers going out on strike and winning. During this pandemic, we might actually be in a strike wave. I mean, it's so hard to tell. I mean, you know, all these journalists are getting laid off. You know, government offices right. are shut down. Nobody's counting. But anecdotally, you're hearing all these stories of workers at a McDonald's store just going on strikes. They're like, look, you got to give us better protective gear, or we're not going to work. Amazon fulfillment centers, you know, there are tons of strikes going on in them over for personal protective gear.
Well, and interestingly, there have been places that started opening back up, but at the wage they were offering, some of their workers that had been displaced by the pandemic right. were making more from stimulus and unemployment bonus money that they don't want to go back to work because they're right. making more money not working there.
I refusal to, I call that a refusal to work. I call that a strike. So the good news is people are learning how to strike. People are learning that some of their power comes from saying no, you know, or as I say in the book, you know, our power is based in the work that we do and our occasional refusal to do it. So that's very positive. And I like to joke in some of these interviews I'm doing that, you know, I really can't wait till we all get back to work so we can turn around and go on strike right away.
Ironic.
But it is a little bit worrying that, you know, I mean, if we are heading into a Great Depression, it means just as we learned how to strike, we're gonna lose our jobs. But I think that just makes strikes more of a political thing. And certainly this pandemic UI, you know, July 1 is going to be a huge date. I think you're gonna see more protest activity over if there is congressional inaction, because people are gonna start to demand this as their right, as they should.
Should governors around the country have looked at what work could be done safely versus what they themselves determined was essential and non-essential?
I mean, you know, I think more should be shut down, frankly. I mean, I live down the street from one of our hospitals on Staten Island where I live. And so, you know, I see, you know, 10 ambulances go by, you know, in an hour. This really is a very dangerous and deadly virus. And I'm, you know, I think the pressure to quote unquote reopen society is going to lead to a second wave and even a third wave. And we're going to lose 250,000 people in this country. So I think that more should have been shut down. And, you know, it's sort of a sick joke that what seems to get you defined as essential is if you're black, brown, and don't have a lot of power. And so meatpacking plants, you know, food processing is a real vector of
stocking grocery store shelves, checkout clerks, truck drivers.
The grocery store is essential. You got to eat, you know, people have to be able to shop. And fortunately, you know, a lot of grocery stores are unionized. A lot of it depends on sort of the relationship between the employer and the union. I would say that, you know, we've got a chain here called Stop and Shop. I think it's Giant or Eagle where you are, where, you know, the union, the company's actually been good and really worked with the union so that the workers got extra pay. There's a lot more protective gear in place. There's a lot more consciousness of social distancing. There's, you know, aisles were removed, so there's more room to avoid people. So they're doing the responsible thing for what is an actual essential business, you know. I have a garden in my backyard. It's not a farm, you know. we got to go chop it. But then, you know, then there are other supermarkets that weren't as generous, you know, and ShopRite, another chain around here, you know, after a couple of weeks, you know, they took away the $2 bonus pay that they were giving people, you know, just because the pressure to open up and the fact that more companies were opening up was like, well, what makes you so special anymore? And that's really lousy. The pandemic really shows just how unequal and how unfair a system. But I do think that there's a story here that where companies were unionized, workers got taken care of a lot better. And the employers, you know, were able to have less of a take it or leave it attitude towards their workers. And again, the pandemic pandemic unemployment insurance also helps because then, you know, individual workers still have the agency to say, you know what, I'm going on layoff. This deal is good, but it's not good enough for me. So that kind of bargaining power and that kind of leverage was very important. But you know, 90% of workers don't have any union protections at all. And so it's been a very dangerous situation for workers.
Is there a movement afoot, or are there just several writers around the country like yourself that are arguing there should be?
I would say that there is a sort of an emerging policy consensus in Washington, D.C. And I'm not in Washington, D.C., which is one reason why I wrote the book. there is like a real group think that happens in D.C. policy circles, even in among liberal and progressive policy circles, that could be unhelpful. And I think that there are some deeper questions that I'm trying to get at that weren't on the table and that need to be. Because right now, you know, the labor law reform is this thing called the PRO Act. And Biden's really, you know, his labor platform is basically, I'll sign the PRO Act. And the PRO Act would repeal Taft-Hartley, which is great, but it's not good enough. It wouldn't put a union in every workplace in America. And in fact, I don't think it would lead to significant union growth because it wouldn't take away the employer's ability to subcontract, to offshore, to freelance out and gigify all these jobs. So you need something that is more deeper and that there is no seceding from. You need all-in systems. There is definitely an emerging consensus, you know, and I think that's possible. So one of the things, you know, that I say in the book is, you know, we on the left frequently we don't understand our history very well. We think of the New Deal as happening all at once, and actually it wasn't. Like, Roosevelt was trying one thing, And it didn't work. And then he tried something else. And it's that so-called Second New Deal that's really the stuff that lasted and the stuff that we appreciate out of the New Deal, a lot of the workers' rights legislation and you know, Social Security and overtime pay and stuff like that. But we tell ourselves that, you know, there's not going to be a change unless we get to the general strike. And it's almost like, well, we shouldn't be thinking about what the change should look like. We should be focused on, getting to the general strike, as if we can't walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. I mean, we should be thinking about, you know, because if we did, you know, if we did have the sit-down strikes come back tomorrow, well, what would we get? The PRO Act? That's not good enough. We need to have like a whole shelf of policies that are ready to go. But the other thing about it is the other thing that's disempowering. But what we tell ourselves is it's not entirely true that it only happens with the general strike. That it's only because of the sit-down strikes that we got the National Labor Relations Act. In 1933, unions were just weak. They were. It was an absolute low point for unions. We weren't powerful, and most unions didn't even support Roosevelt for his election. But his signature policy initiative in his first year, the National Industrial Recovery Act, included what's called Section 7A, the right to organize. It said the federal government guarantees that workers have a right to organize. Was not worth the paper it was written on because there was no enforcement mechanism. And employers violated it with impunity. They weren't just firing workers who formed a union. They were firing on the workers that formed a union. They were still shooting unionists in 1933. But that endorsement of the right to organize was just enough to raise workers' hopes and expectations, and then dash those expectations. And that's what actually got the strikes going. The strike wave in 1934 is really triggered by the labor codes that were coming down from the National Recovery Act were lousy, and workers were organizing, and employers were shooting at them, workers were getting frustrated and were going on strike. So there's sort of a dialectic that happens. So I think we're there. I think that if we get a Democratic administration in January, there's a real recognition that they got to do things for workers fast. It's not going to be good enough, whatever it is, but it might be just enough to get more strike activity and more organizing going. That'll really put the pressure on for something that's more durable and that we deserve.
Sean, this is a fascinating conversation, especially for anyone who worked out, you know, who grew up in a union town as I have. It's about time for us to wrap up, but I always give guests an opportunity to let people know where they can find out more about what we've been talking about. Obviously, your book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, is a great place to start. But do you have a website?
I do. My name is spelled Shaunrichman, and my website is seanrichman.org.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for spending this time with me today. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care. Bye. Yeah, Sean is Sean Richman is a labor organizer, teacher, and author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. We're going to talk about a different kind of work in different myths and models about startups in the next hour. But right now we're going to take a short break. If you're listening to us on WFOV 92.1 FM, Our Voices Radio in Flint, they are a broadcast service of the Flint Odyssey House Spectacle Productions and my good friend Paul Herring. We're going to let them squeeze a few words in edgewise. If you're streaming us at TomSumnerProgram.com, we have some messages as well. So don't touch that dial. Don't click that mouse. We'll be right back.
Hello there, citizens. Darkwing Duck here. And every time I'm in Flint fighting crime, I always stop by the Tom Sumner program. Don't forget, stay dangerous. Darkwing Duck out.
The Tom Sumner Program plays host to the best political roundtable on radio every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon. Armchair Politics features great commentary and analysis about the headlines from local, state, and national politics with an alumni of world-class pundits, plus quotes, tweets, and those weird and wacky stories we call the X-Files. If it's Wednesday, catch Armchair Politics on the Tom Sumner Program.
Shimmer is a dessert topping.
It's a floor wax.
It's a dessert topping.
It's a floor wax, I'm telling you.
It's a dessert topping, you cow! Hey, calm down, you two. New Shimmer's a floor wax and a dessert topping. Here, I'll spray some on your mop and some on your butterscotch pudding. Mmm, tastes terrific.
And just look at that shine.
Hey, outlasts every other leading floor wax 2-1. It's durable and it's scuff resistant. And it's delicious. Sure is. Perks up anything from an ice cream sundae to a pumpkin pie.
Made from an exclusive non-yellowing formula.
I haven't even touched my pudding and I'm ready for more.
But what about black heel marks?
Dirt, grime, even black heel marks. Wipe clean with a damp cloth.
Oh, sorry, honey. I'll clean that up.
Oh, no problem, sweetheart. Not with new Shimmer.
New Shimmer, for the greatest shine you ever tasted.
Do you have feelings of inadequacy? Do you suffer from shyness? Do you sometimes wish you were more assertive? If you answered yes to any of these questions, ask your doctor or pharmacist about tequila. Tequila is the safe, natural way to feel better and more confident about yourself and your actions. Tequila can help ease you out of your shyness and let you tell the world that you're ready and willing to do just about anything. You'll notice the benefits of tequila almost immediately, and with a regimen of regular doses, you can overcome any obstacles that prevent you from living the life you want to live. Shyness and awkwardness will be a thing of the past, and you'll discover many talents you never knew you had. Stop hiding and start living with tequila. Tequila may not be right for everyone. Women who are pregnant or nursing should not use tequila. However, women who wouldn't mind nursing or becoming pregnant are encouraged to try it. Side effects may include dizziness, nausea, vomiting, incarceration, erotic lustfulness, loss of motor control, loss of clothing, loss of money, loss of virginity, delusions of grandeur, table dancing, headache, dehydration, dry mouth, and a desire to sing karaoke and play all night rounds of strip poker, truth or dare, and naked twister. Warning, the consumption of alcohol may make you think you're whispering when you're not. It's a major factor in dancing like a retard. May cause you to tell your friends over and over again that you're in love with them. Also may cause you to think you can sing. Alcohol may lead you to believe that ex-lovers are really dying for you to telephone them at 4 a.m. Alcohol may make you think you can logically converse with members of the opposite sex without spitting. It may create the illusion that you are tougher, smarter, faster, and better looking than most people. And it may lead you to think people are laughing with you. Alcohol may cause pregnancy, and it also may be a major factor in getting your ass kicked. So what are you waiting for? Stop hiding and start living with tequila. Tequila!
Those hands, no matter whose they are, can spread the germs of many common diseases. That's why I want you to realize how important it is to keep hands clean, to wash them regularly and always before meals with Lifebuoy, which not only removes dirt, but helps to remove germs. Teach the children this habit. Form it yourself. Always use Lifebuoy for hands and face as well as scent.
This is U.S. Senator Gary Peters, and you're listening to the Tom Sumner Program.
The only reason we're here is to make sure that you got a voice. That's it.
There we go.
Don't for a second. Don't think for a second that he represents who these cops are from all over the county and around this nation. We go out there to help people, not do that nonsense.
There we go.
I just want to tell you, where's my man? Right there. Where's the gentleman?
Oh, I think he took off.
Yeah, my man.
He took off.
Pastor Hawkins, see, I was going to tell you, we want to be with y'all for real. So I took the helmet off and laid the batons down. I want to make this a parade, not a protest. So listen, I'm just telling you, these cops love you. That cop over there hugs people, so you tell us what you need to do.
Walk with us! Walk with us! Walk with us! Walk with us! Walk with us!
want this, sir.
Let's go!
Tennessee County is
dead. They're going to walk with us. They're going to walk with us.
What is segregation?
I don't know what segregation is.
What is bigotry?
I don't know what bigotry is.
What does hatred mean?
I don't know what it is.
What is prejudice?
I think it's when somebody's sick.
Rise and shine, boys!
1, 2, 3, 4! 1, 2, 3, 4!
Coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now. Police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin. Dallas, Texas. The Flash, apparently official. President John F. Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Anybody here see my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone? He's freed a lot of people, but it seems the good they die young.
That's a cold days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live.
No one can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed.
Yordi has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So, my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible?
Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot.
Director Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. Get the gun. Get the gun. Get the gun. Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. All right. That's it, Raper. Get it. Get the gun, Raper. Hold him. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty. That is the way he lived. That is what he leaves us. My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today, pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times, in many parts of this nation, those he touched and who sought to touch him. Some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone.
What is segregation?
I don't know what segregation is.
What is bigotry?
I don't know what bigotry is.
What does hatred mean?
I don't know what it is.
What is prejudice?
I think it's when somebody's sick.
As I walk through this wicked world, searching for light in the dark depths of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain and hatred and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Hi, I'm Alexander Zonjic. Don't touch that dial. You're listening to Tom Sumner.